When we decided to have a symposium like this and talk about what issues we have to talk about, this panel seemed like a fairly natural one because UCS has worked on these issues for a very long time. And I would say that it's hard to imagine putting together a better panel of people to talk about this than the people who are here with me today. So I'm really pleased that we were able to do this. We're going to start off with Victoria Sampson talking about missile defense. Victoria is now the Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation. Previously, she worked with the Center for Defense Information, where she was really one of the key people in Washington who worked on and followed missile defense issues. Her focus now is more on space security issues, I'm sure it's in her blood enough that she hasn't been able to let this go past. And I think really is one of the people who really has followed not only the technology and politics of this, but also some of the strategic issues, and asked her to talk about all of those kinds of things. Following her will be John Steinbrenner, professor of public policy at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. John is somebody I've known for a very long time, and I would have to say he's really one of my heroes in the field. He's been involved in these issues through the National Academy of Sciences and a number of other venues. And again, is one of the people who I think takes one of the most thoughtful approaches to these issues and really has, on a range of issues related to security, has been deeply involved with him for a long time. Today we'll talk about space security issues. So, Victoria.
I was asked at the break whether I wanted to go first or second. I thought, oh, I don't want to follow Congress with Murphy. That's quite a relevant speech there. So I'll try and do my best. What I'll be speaking about is missile defense. As David said, in my new capacity to secure world foundation, I focus on space issues. So what we're going to do is my own personal opinion on missile defense. I was asked to speak a little bit about the history of missile defense, just to kind of build into current issues. Looking out at this crowd and having heard the history of the new concerned scientists, I feel probably this is a little bit of an overview that you may already know, but just to make sure we're, to put it in the proper context. Well, basically, the United States has been working on missile defense almost as long as there have been ballistic missiles. The Germans' V2 ballistic missile during World War II has sometimes been called the first terror weapon. So almost immediately from the 1940s on, the United States has been working on some sort of way to counter that. In the 1950s, they were looking at nuclear tipped interceptors. Right now, we shift away from that more to directly intercepting and basically shooting out a bullet with a bullet. But there were several iterations of ballistic missile defense during the 1950s and then later in the 1960s. These all centered on nuclear tipped interceptors, trying first to counter the Soviet threat. And then in the 1960s, it was really focused even more so on the Chinese ballistic missile threat. And then 1972, of course, we had the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, which prevented throwing any kind of a national missile defense except at specific sites. The United States decided to protect our ICBM silos. The Soviet Union decided to protect Moscow, so there are missile defense sites legally allowed in Tibet. And actually, it also was forgotten is that the United States has deployed a national missile defense system before. We deployed a system in the mid-1970s. It was active for one day, and then Congress quickly shut it down just because of funding reasons. Also, a realization that from a technological standpoint, it was rather ridiculous. Of course, a lot of people, the idea of missile defense really came to fruition during the Reagan era, the 1983 speech of calling for a strategic defense initiative, or Star Wars. And that's really where a lot of the funding counts go back to. Oftentimes, I'm asked, well, how much has the United States spent on missile defense ever? And it's really difficult to say because it's shifted program name, it's shifted responsibility, looking at numbers. But a fairly safe way in which to count about it is saying, okay, looking back to 1983, over $150 million has been spent on missile defense. And the Star Wars initiative really focused on a space-based effort, trying to get space-based lasers, X-ray lasers, whole constellations of interceptors up in space. So it's really heavily focused on creating a so-called impenetrable bubble, which is technologically difficult, and almost from the very beginning, I think that Congress and the DoD realized that it would be unrealistic. But money was spent to try and see, okay, well, how can we do the technological development on this? Under the George H.W. Bush administration, they kind of dialed that back a notch, really in Pebble's concept, saying, okay, we're focusing more, forget the X-ray laser, space-based laser, not so much, really looking at the brilliant Pebble, where you have hundreds if not thousands of interceptors up in space to try and shoot down those missiles during the current phase. But it wasn't with the Bush 41 administration that you first actually saw ballistic missile defense being used in a wartime situation. Under the first Gulf War, you may remember, of course, Iraq, their studs were used against American troops, and you had one very serious incident where Iraq's stud killed American troops in a bunker in 1991, February 25th, 1991. So that really kind of spurred the United States to say, okay, well, let's not so much focus on defending against ICBM types of missiles, because that's an entirely different type of threat. Let's focus more on defending against short-range ballistic missiles. Short-range ballistic missiles fly slower, they fly lower. It's an entirely different level of threat when you're trying to intercept an ICBM. And the studs, of course, of short-range ballistic missiles, we're talking maybe a couple hundred miles, as opposed to ICBMs, which can be 5,000 to 10,000 miles, depending on what they're. So what the United States did is they rushed an area defense system called the Patriot into the theater in Iraq in 1981. And you may remember at that time, there were great stories saying, you know, the Patriot's doing wonderful things. It's at 100% intercept rate. President Bush in 1981 said, you know, thank God for the Patriot. Later on, independent oversight said that they were much less successful in intercept rate than we originally had anticipated. A kind way of, an overly generous way of looking at the intercept rate was maybe 9% intercept success. Realistically speaking, it's doubtful that the Patriots actually did what they said they were able to do. And I bring that up not to beat a dead horse, but then just to say, you know, again, we're often dangled promises of what technology can accomplish and what we would like to accomplish, and oftentimes what we can't accomplish and we'd like to accomplish are confused. Under the Clinton administration, you saw a continuation of national missile defense research, but you also saw more of a focus on looking at, okay, how can we defend against short-range ballistic missiles? You had an alteration in the anti-ballistic missile treaty to reflect the end of the Cold War, namely the former Soviet republics that had been involved in it, they could sign on and be part of the ABM treaty. Also allowed the development of missile defenses such as the Patriot, theater missile defense is what they're called, defending against short-range ballistic missiles. That was allowed in the ABM treaty. Under the Bush 43 administration, the G.W. Bush, of course, there was a heavy emphasis on missile defense from the very beginning. In June 2000, when George Bush was running for office, he talked about the need for a ballistic missile defense. His National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, was scheduled to give a speech on September 11, 2003, which would talk about the most pressing national security threat to the United States. It was to talk about the threat of ballistic missiles to the United States. Obviously, that speech was never given. But it does indicate the emphasis that the George Bush administration did focus on this. And of course, 3 months after September 11th, the George W. Bush administration announced that they would be, you know, on the drawing of the ABM treaty. The excuse that they gave at that time was that, well, we've reached the level of development and really are coming up against the boundaries of the treaty. They were not. But they just wanted, as many things in that administration, they wanted to be able to work unilaterally without looking outside by an international agreement. And many in that administration saw the ABM treaty as that kind of tie in their hands they didn't want to have to deal with. As well, under the G.W. Bush administration, they changed the entity in the Pentagon that was designed to defend against ballistic missiles. They created what had been called the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization. They changed it to be the Missile Defense Agency, which basically was relieved of all the reporting requirements that the Pentagon weapon systems normally have to do. Normally when they develop missile or weapon systems, they have to say, okay, here's what we want, here's what we think it's going to cost, here's the sort of capabilities we needed to hit, here are the milestones. Missile defense is crucial enough, you just develop what you want, we'll figure out what we can do at the end. So as you can imagine, that's not a very good way to have oversight to make sure you're actually going to have things develop the way you intend them to. Spending on missile defense during the George W. Bush administration also increased and went from about $3 billion a year to anywhere between $10 and $12 billion a year by the end of the administration. They started to deploy missile defenses. They started to deploy interceptors in California and Alaska. These were land-based interceptors that were designed to defend the continental, the United States proper, against long-range ICBM attacks. The excuse they gave at that point was that, well, we defend North Korea. North Korea is such a pressing threat, we need to defend against explosive missiles. I'll go into later, but North Korea's explosive missiles were not that pressing of a threat. And finally, during the George W. Bush administration, we saw the second Iraq War, where you actually had ballistic missiles being used. Again, they had a later iteration of the Patriot missile defense system called the PAC-3. Again, there were great, volleys of praise sent towards the PAC-3, but that could be a whole discussion of itself, but essentially its utility is highly doubtful. So looking at the current status of the missile defense systems, what we have right now, there are basically, as I said before, there are different missile defenses depending what kind of missile threat you're trying to defend against. But a lot of the controversy has geared on is what I mentioned before, the system that's deployed in Alaska and California, known as the Ground-Based Missile Defense System, or the GMD system. They have a couple dozen interceptors that have been placed in the ground there. They'd like to place some more in. The problem that they run into is that they rush them out in the field so quickly because the North Korea threat is so quote-unquote pressing that it actually has to pull a lot of the interceptors out of the silos and retrofit them because they're actually falling apart in the silos, which again goes back to the lack of oversight that we had during the last administration. There are all sorts of different types of missile defense systems. Like I said before, there's a ship-based system. I'll go into that a little bit more when we start talking about European missile defense. There's several types of mobile systems. So really, we have a lot of money in different types of ballistic missile defense systems. The missile threat, the main one that is used for missile defense, if you look at, if you're trying to defend against short-range ballistic missiles, there are many countries that have short-range ballistic missiles, absolutely. The thing is, most of them are allies. Or if you look at the Missile Defense Agency's website, they say, look at all these countries that have ballistic missiles, they're wanting to spend money on missile defense. A lot of them are countries like the United Arab Emirates, who we want to sell the missile defense systems to. Or, countries that we are working in conjunction together to develop missile defense systems on. So if there's not that really pressing of a short-range ballistic missile threat. The long-range ballistic missile threat is even less doubtful. I don't think anyone seriously thinks Russia or China will be launching ICBMs at the United States anytime soon. The two countries that are always used are North Korea and Iran. North Korea has never successfully flown this long-range ballistic missile. Iran has been doing some work on space launch capabilities, but again, at best they can reach Israel, which leads into my discussion on the European missile defense system. That's been one of the big changes under the current Obama administration, is the change in emphasis for what they're trying to do with missile defense. They're looking at, originally the Bush administration, the G.W. Bush administration wanted to deploy 10 interceptors in Poland with a radar in the Czech Republic. The Obama administration said, well, we're going to actually look at what we think the threat is. We don't really see the Iranian threat towards Europe or the United States being as pressing as previous administration has thought. So they've shifted more towards a ship-based missile defense system. With the idea of, okay, we're going to try and do ship-based missile defenses, eventually the ship-based interceptors are going to put on the ground. But we're also going to research the interceptor that the George Bush administration wanted to have just in case. So they're kind of hedging their bets. So for me, there's not so much a big change in what the Obama administration wants to do for missile defense. It's more a change in that attitude, saying, okay, we realize the ballistic missile threat is not quite so pressing. We have time to investigate other opportunities. Whereas the Bush administration said, pull out all the stops, get something out in the field. We don't care whether, what it is. We used to joke that if they put a telephone pole covered with tinfoil, that would be sufficient for the Bush administration. They just need something in the ground to demonstrate they were doing something. The Obama administration has pulled back somewhat from that. A couple other things that the Obama administration is looking at is one of the major issues of the future for missile defense. The Obama administration has kind of stepped back from some of the more, egregiously expensive missile defense systems. I know this is kind of ridiculous to say, well, one missile defense system is more expensive than the other because they're all billions of dollars. But they did announce they were canceling the second airborne laser aircraft, which is good because the first airborne laser aircraft is about 9 years late. It's tripled its cost. It hasn't actually tried to shoot anything down yet. It was supposed to shoot down a ballistic missile attempt later on this year. So far, that hasn't happened. They've canceled a few of the more high-in-the-sky technological development programs for the Missile Defense Agency, the Kinetic Energy Interceptor, the multi-fuel vehicle. It's kind of ironic. The Kinetic Energy Interceptor program, when they announced in May that they're canceling it, they said, yeah, actually, it's been such a hush-hush sort of thing. The program manager didn't even know this program was being canceled until we just announced it, which is, again, unusual for the Bush administration. Things got leaked. So what we're looking at is a different perception of the threat, looking more towards, okay, what is realistically likely to happen versus what is a hysterical 1% chance of happening, which had been the previous administration's approach towards missile defense. As was mentioned during the nuclear weapons discussion before lunch, there are various reviews going on. As part of the nuclear posture review that the Defense Department is undertaking, they're doing a ballistic missile defense system review to try and figure out, okay, what do we really need to do in terms of missile defense? The results from that have not come out yet. I anticipate they'll be leaked as soon as it comes out. But I really think it's going to be more of a status quo sort of thing. Again, maybe dialing back some of the spending. But I would like to point out the Obama administration, their missile defense request for the FY 2010 budget, which is the most recent one they had, was about $8 billion. You know, it was only down a couple billion from the Bush administration, which is not that big of a reduction when you come right down to it. Another couple questions looking at in terms of why is missile defense still relevant? You know, if we're talking about Star Wars, Soviet Union's gone, why is this even still an issue? Well, I'll start with the fact that, as I said before, anywhere between $8 to $10 billion is being spent on this program at a time when the economy is doing poorly and just, you know, decisions have to be made. You cannot fund everything. And missile defense is affecting more strategic relations as well. As was discussed during the nuclear weapons discussion, there are a START treaty being renegotiated to determine whether or not we want to continue that nuclear weapons reductions treaty from the Cold War era or post-Cold War era. Russia was very upset about the United States' plans to put missile defense in Europe. They thought that, well, either it's secretly geared towards Russia, and that the interceptors that the United States is placing on the ground, sure, they say it's for Iran. We don't see any problem with Iran. There's no ballistic missile threat there, which, to be fair to Russia, a lot of analysts in the United States do agree with them on that part. So they say, okay, Iran isn't actually the threat. Who is? And so they say, oh, okay, obviously missile defense is being geared towards us. Also, there are a lot of Russian scientists who are absolutely convinced that the only real way to do missile defense sort of system is with nuclear tipped interceptors. So they think, okay, well, the United States is saying that they're directly hitting it, you know, shooting down a bullet with a bullet, but that's not what they're planning on doing. They're planning on doing nuclear tipped interceptors. So missile defense affected strategic discussions because the Russians said, well, you guys want to talk about START treaty, you're trying to renegotiate that kind of arms reductions. Frankly, we're kind of nervous. We're not sure what you have planned there. We don't know if you want to go along with it. When the United States announced that, okay, we're going to be pulling back from what we had planned for the European missile defense, the Russians did indicate that they say, okay, we're going to do it. And last I heard, I could be wrong on this, but it seems the treaty is supposed to be negotiated by December. Supposedly, Obama wants to sign the treaty before he gets his Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in mid-December. So that's the latest deadline. Who knows where that's actually going to come to fruition. A few other things. When we're trying to develop a missile defense system directly against Iran, that of course increases tension with Iran, which may affect our ability to discuss other things with them, i.e. their uranium enrichment programs. It just makes it a little more difficult, to say the least, to coordinate things with them. Or even if we're upsetting Russia because of our missile defense plans, it gets difficult to have them help us out with what we'd like to do with Iran. Because they say, well, if you're not going to cooperate with us on that particular issue, why should we cooperate with you on your kind of issues? Also, another thing about why missile defense is so contentious. In the end, it comes down to two things, I think. One is political. Missile defense, the 1994 contract with America that Newt Gingrich put in the Republican Congress, it was the only national security plank that was part of that. For some reason, missile defense has become a tenet of the Republican Party as a way in which to indicate that they're tough on national security. And it's very difficult to have, I think, a reasonable discussion. Even when they start talking about in the Obama administration, okay, we're still going to do European missile defense, we're just going to do it a different sort of way. There was, you know, hair was torn out, and tears of rage came out of various members of Congress, saying, well, you're giving up our national security. And the last part is, I think a lot of this has to do, when people say, you know, looking at it, there's not really a threat, the technology isn't really there, you know, it's upsetting your international allies. Why is the United States moving ahead with missile defense? What is the momentum that's causing it to go forward? I think a lot of it has to do, and this sounds very simplistic, but I think it has a major factor, is just $10 billion goes a very long ways in terms of jobs and contracts. If you look at the various missile defense agency websites of the various programs, you can see maps of the United States, and they'll say, okay, here's a map of the United States, and here where all the jobs are related to the airborne laser, here where all the jobs are related to the ground-based mid-course defense system. $10 billion goes a very long ways in terms of ensuring jobs across various congressional districts. In 2008, Boeing had three studies in Arizona, Alaska, and Alabama to indicate how many jobs were directly related to their missile defense work as a way in which to say, okay, FYI. And in June, as soon as the budget request was released for this coming year, Boeing immediately started saying, well, you know, we're going to have to start cutting some jobs. You're changing our missile defense programs, we're going to have to do that. To a certain extent, yes, of course, we're cutting back on budgets, jobs will be affected. But I think it's being used as a wedge to really have a reasonable discussion of this issue. And so that's where it helps to have a scientific viewpoint to say, okay, well, what are you looking at? What do you reasonably expect to be able to achieve? You know, jobs are one thing, but can it actually do what you want it to do? If not, then there's really no point in continuing on for national security reasons. And so, and with that, I'm out of time, and I'll go up. I'm done. Thank you.
So we'll hold questions till the end, and I ask John to continue.
One of the consequences of the information revolution that Congressman Markey was talking about is that PowerPoint software has induced me, A, to make legible notes, and B, to inflict them on everyone else. So that's what I'll do here. I'm actually just...
hit the escape key. Thank you.
Just
to say, I'm hit down.
All right. And I'm going to basically sketch a very broad view of the current situation and try to project it forward a little bit. And I want to talk mainly about space. And as I would characterize the current situation in space, we're in a process of very lengthy and very gradual transformation from an originating situation in which the original purpose of virtually all space activity was to support military confrontation. That was the origins of the 1950s. To much broader social and economic functions, communication and commercial communication and navigation becoming integral to daily life. And Earth observation for environmental management is becoming increasingly significant. And those functions are gradually absorbing greater significance, although they're not currently actually driving the investment programs. The prevailing legal, financial, and institutional arrangements are basically incompletely adapted to this necessary expansion of purpose. So we're in transition over a somewhat uncertain time from an originating situation to predictably something will look very different eventually. The notable problems associated with this transition are that there is an inherent tension between the principle of equitable utilization, which is fundamental to the entire legal regime in space, and the impulse to use it for a competitive national advantage. The Outer Space Treaty in 1967 codified the essential principle of all utilization of space, which is that you cannot extend sovereign jurisdiction up into orbit, and in a process of establishing that point, which was necessary actually to do anything. The rest of the world said, well, if we're going to agree to that principle, then we're going to have to agree that the environment in question is a common heritage of mankind, and therefore it's got to be subject to equitable rules. That is the fundamental legal principle necessary to do anything up there. And it's necessitated by basic physics or dynamics. That has generally been interpreted to allow military support activities, intelligence, observation, communication, navigation, etc., but not weaponization. However, the distinction between legitimate military support and objectionable weaponization has not been completely specified in legal terms. In particular, the Outer Space Treaty does not explicitly prohibit conventional weapons or acts of interference. Moreover, in addition to the legal ambiguity, the distinction has been sharply contested in recent years, last 8 or 9 years, by apparently authoritative U.S. policy documents emanating largely from military planners, which have stated repeatedly the aspiration to dominate space for national military advantage and to deny similar effort by any other country. We're saying basically we want to see anything that moves, attack it when we don't like it, and prevent anyone else from doing the same thing. Now, the American public doesn't read those documents, and the American press pays zero attention to them, but military planners outside the United States do read them, and are at least faced with the question of how seriously they ought to take them. In that context, U.S. missile defense aspirations that Victoria was just summarizing historically have all along conflicted with the global aspirations to prevent space weaponization. The last negotiations on this subject were in 1979. They were with the Soviet Union. They were suspended, and still officially just suspended, in reaction to their invasion of Afghanistan. And ever then, thereafter, as the Reagan administration came in shortly thereafter, we have simply refused to talk about the subject, recognizing that any elaboration of the current rules will, in some way, fairly serious way, get in the way of our aspirations for developing ballistic missiles. Any test or deployment of a space-based system would be a direct contradiction. As a matter of fact, all strategic range ballistic missile interceptors in any basic mode, do confer an inherent capability to attack satellites. Because basically of this aspiration to pursue ballistic missile defense unencumbered by any opinion or interest from the rest of the world, we have refused to negotiate on that subject. Annually, the UN General Assembly votes an urgent resolution arguing for negotiations. Everyone in the world on one side, the United States, Israel, and the Marshall Islands on the other side. Continuously every year we get outvoted on that matter. What are reasonable expectations about the evolution? So the story here is the long-term evolution of the environment is at odds with current U.S. policy. I think it's clear or sort of reasonable to project over some period of time that the increasing importance of broad space support services will eventually induce more complete legal specification. Let's hope that will occur fairly soon. The Obama administration has made positive noises about initiating negotiations, but they haven't yet done it. It's reasonable to anticipate that when we get around to do it, and we will have to, the focus of attention will focus on prohibiting acts of interference as distinct from trying to ban the capacity for interference, and that would be, if you will, a somewhat new strand of arms control. There's no way to prevent the capacity for interfering in space, and so you'll have to establish that as a behavioral rule and monitor compliance with that. In order to do that, we undoubtedly are going to have to define some limits on legitimate military support functions. In particular, to the extent that we're using them in support of long-range attack that other countries find objectionable, we're going to have to provide some reassurance in that regard. Limits are out in front of what our current support capabilities are, but we're at least going to have to discuss that issue. And I think it's predictable also that there would be demand for more equitable sharing of information. At the moment, the United States is the basic source for space awareness, i.e. keeping track of all the objects that are up there. We operate the technology, the sort of network of sensors that does this. And then we choose to tell what the rest of the world what we want to tell them. I think it's predictable, as this evolves over time, that A, more people are going to be involved in providing awareness, and B, that the flow of information is going to be more equitably specified. Against that projection, there is the contrary impulse for decisive competitive advantage. What I would argue is that over the very long term, that impulse will fade because it is wildly unrealistic. It will never be legitimate in global judgment. The principle of common heritage of mankind will be preserved, and dominance for national advantage is in contradiction to that. But in addition to being not legitimate, it is not achievable at any realistic cost. Even the United States will be able actually to control access to space to the extent that our military planning documents said that we should attempt to do. It's just not something that realistically can be done. The immediate imperative now, therefore, I think, is to initiate formal negotiations to update the legal regime. It's a very easy thing to do. You don't have to decide anything. You just decide we'll talk. The rest of the world will receive that actually as a revolution because we've refused to talk about this officially for 30 years. It's easy to do. It doesn't require any congressional resolution, but it is a reversal of policy of some 30-year standing. Nonetheless, I think it is not unreasonable to hope it will occur because it is quite clearly in the long run fundamental U.S. interest. U.S. space policy has basically been hijacked by a group of people who are pursuing very narrow military objectives, and they have not actually served the interests of the broader military community, mostly interested in military support functions, and they certainly have not served the interests of the increasingly significant commercial industry and scientific I do think there is hope that simple step will be taken, that we will agree to initiate formal negotiations. There are political hints, but not yet a decision to do so. But let me end with a practical observation. The U.S. Ballistic Missile Defense Program, which Tori just summarized for you, is really more a political project than a strategic project. Underneath it all, there is virtually no prospect that a standalone missile defense system is going to perform any meaningful military function. And the UCS itself has pointed out the reasons that anybody able to create a ballistic missile in the first place can create the penetration techniques required to get through any system we can put up, provided it isn't the nuclear tip. The reason why nobody dares even talk about nuclear interceptors is that the disruption of the space environment would be so extreme that not even the very tolerant American political discussion would sit still for that. Space-based interceptors that use nuclear warheads are just way outside the bounds of legitimacy. But if you don't use nuclear warheads, you're not going to be very effective. That's the fundamental dilemma. All of which is to say that whatever functions ballistic missile defense perform, it's largely in terms of political symbolism rather than real security protection. The space-based component is particularly unrealistic. Nonetheless, the idea is politically very entrenched, and so there will be an emotional fight over any supposition that we will legally define a rule that would prevent space-based deployment. Even though it really can't happen, people will fight to the death over the political death over the right to do so. A peculiar characteristic of our political system. I wish I could change it, but not very likely. Therefore, let me just conclude with a somewhat sobering note. The difficulty of disciplining this aspiration, the ballistic missile defense aspiration, deep in our history, is the primary impediment to the development of a space regime that is more responsive to the actual situation and to our real interests. We are going to have to come to terms with an intense minority within our country that has been advancing a conception that is unrealistic in strategic terms, is not responsive to the real security interests of the United States, but has had a free ride, basically, for nearly 30 years in our political system. It's a political problem, fundamentally. Sorry to have to say that to a group of scientists. Nonetheless, you are in a position to keep making the fundamental point that the long-term interest in regulating this regime is to provide, if you will, elaboration of the legal rules to protect all the uses that we undertake, and that we need to discipline this ballistic missile defense aspiration in order to do that. Thank you.
We have about 15 minutes for questions and discussion. We don't have a microphone for questions from the audience, so please stand up and speak loudly. I'll try and take the questions in the order I see them. Yes, sir.
I'm Chuck Williams, a scientist, and thank you for introducing themselves. With China about to put a man on the moon, I mean, they really announced that they're going to be active in space, and Japan likely to become active in space. Is that going to change the political landscape and the view of missile defense?
Well, China, it's interesting. They're very, I guess, excited about their space program. And but the problem you run into is, I think, the same thing here. There's a difference between what the scientists are saying and what the politicians are actually doing. And so you have a lot of scientists. I think we have some China experts here who can clarify what they're actually planning on doing. Gregory, if you want to speak up on this. It's my understanding that they're not really going to be putting man on the moon anytime soon. What they're looking at doing is more moon, lunar exploration, kind of like what India's been doing. Mariana, yes?
Yeah, the Chinese plans for their space program in the short to medium term, running up through 2020, is to complete robotic exploration of the moon, some deeper probes into the solar system. And their primary objective for their human program is a space station of their own. And they'll be launching the first experimental modules of that next fall. But they do not have a public plan to send humans to the moon.
But China is an element in the U.S. missile defense plans. One of the countries in the United States has been trying to sell missile defense systems too for a very long time is Taiwan. We've been trying to sell the advanced version of our Patriot system to Taiwan. And China, of course, is rather upset about the idea, even though, I mean, reasonably, China could very easily overwhelm whatever missile defense systems we try to sell to Taiwan. So there's a political element there as well. Also, in terms of China's ASAT test in 2007, my opinion is that the United States shot down one of our own satellites in 2008 directly in response to China's 2007 ASAT test. And of course, our 2008, the interceptor that we used for our own ASAT test was a modified U.S. missile defense interceptor. It was a ship-based one, and one that's going to be largely deployed around the world. So they're intertwined between the two.
And just noting, we have both Gregory and Jeffrey Lewis in the audience who know the most, I think, any American about the China space program. What I would characterize what they are saying is that China has an interest in developing and promoting, if you will, equitable legal rules for regulating space, and they want to be part of the process. And that not unreasonably. And that, in fact, China and Russia have been the two who have been advancing in Geneva to CD various sort of candidate treaty texts for the next stage of these negotiations, China being the primary initiator, actually. So they are basically asking for negotiations, and we are basically refusing to do it.
Let me just reiterate what John said. Gregory Kulaki and Jeffrey Lewis, who are sitting back here, are probably not only two of the main U.S. experts in the Chinese space program, but have also looked more closely at the background of the Chinese ASAT test in 2007 than anybody else has. So if you have questions, find them during the break. Matt, I think you're ready.
Yeah. Matt Schwartz, the NAB for UCS and PNA. I recognize that a lot of the weapon vendors have negotiated sales and manufacturing deals with legislators to actually be situated in almost every state of the union, so that when it's time for them to use their bargaining chips with legislators, they say, well, you can't kill jobs in almost virtually all districts. My question is there some sort of formal countervailing plan or proposal to fund retraining of all of these workers who work for the corporations within the military-industrial complex to sort of placate that concern of a lack of employment of all the workers in the defense contracting corporations?
And the short answer, no. That's a problem we run into. It's once these programs have been started, it's very, very, very difficult to get rid of. You know, you get this forward momentum of funding and jobs that it's very difficult to get rid of. That's why, you know, when I was working on Missile Defense at the Center for Defense Information, we fought very hard to bring information about the space-based missile defense, which the Bush administration and George W. Bush administration had plans for. Initially, they were asking for something like $10 million a year, which is really nothing in terms of DoD spending. You know, it's a drop in the bucket. But, you know, my argument at that point was, okay, that's a toehold. And once you establish that toehold, they're going to grab this hold as tight as strong as they can, and they're going to expand the funding. And so that's why it's important to kind of stop these sort of things before they actually get started.
Let me comment with some care here. I think there is an issue of accountability here that community needs to worry about. I think hard scrutiny at the management of this program, both in technical and in financial terms, is likely to find about what you'd find if you look at Bernie Madoff or AIG or other. And that may be a little strong, but only probably just a little strong. They have operated without serious oversight for quite some time. And we know what happens when human institutions operate without serious oversight for quite some time and misbehave, particularly when they're trying to do something that actually is quite difficult to do. In fact, we've all along understood there is no way, actually, realistically, you're going to make a ballistic missile defense interceptor stand up against an offense that has the initiative. So you're asking them to do something that is technically probably infeasible, and you're letting them run without oversight. You can imagine what it looks like in there, okay? And so I think that is an issue that must be raised, okay? Fine, we're interested in ballistic missile defense. Let's take a good hard look at what's been going on, both the financial management and the operational management of this program. And I can assure you that those contractors, if they are seriously worried about that, are going to be a lot less uppity about discipline. The problem is, how do you get a government to exercise serious legal regulatory oversight. We're having that trouble with the financial system, despite all the evidence that we. Nonetheless, I think ultimately that's coming for them.
And I would just make the point that, as Victoria said, this has become particularly bad in the Missile Defense case because the Missile Defense Agency was exempted from most of the oversight laws the Pentagon has on major programs. So it's been particularly bad.
And you know what's going to happen when that occurs. It's not going to be good performance.
Yeah, I've often said that if you really supported missile defense and you really wanted it to be deployed, the way in which they went about doing it was the worst possible way. Because basically you put out a system that was unformed, way over budget, ridiculously, without any kind of technological constraints. It's a terrible system. If you really think missile defense is needed for our national security, you just shot yourself in the foot with it.
Which is why I called it basically a political project. The way you operate this way indicates political goals, not strategic goals. We have not really been serious about this in strategic terms. This is a political operation.
Other comments, questions? Yeah.
I was going to ask about the technical feasibility of the missile defense system, for instance, whether there have been any realistic tests of a ground-based interceptor, but I suspect the answer is no. In any case, from what John says, it's irrelevant because the system is driven by political forces. It seems to me that this presents an opportunity to UCS to shed light on the problem. It seems like certainly a right problem for good, high-quality investigative journalism, for example. Does UCS have any effort to try to inspire this, just to publicize the situation and inform the public?
We have, over the last, I would say, eight or ten years, tried to look very in detail at the system that's being developed. And one of the things that was interesting about the Bush administration decision to deploy a system was that the system moved from being a view-graph system where nothing was nailed down to being a system where there were specific plans for certain type of sensors, where they're going to be located, what the technology for things were. We have looked very carefully and tried to point out to people the problems that they have with that. And I think, as Victoria said more recently, there has been quite a bit of discussion of some of the programs that were canceled this year as a result of being so far over budget and behind schedule. And so we continue to push on that. The problem we found is that to most of the reporters who know something about this, this is old news, and they've written about this in the past, people like Bill Braun at the time. And so it's very hard to get them geared up to dig into this and talk about it because they say, well, you know, we covered this back in the mid-90s and everybody knows about it. So that's what we're really up against. And so we've tried in our own reports to talk about that, but we found it's very difficult to get to really get it on the in a national paper and a really very high profile forum of that kind. But we'll keep trying.
Right. In terms of just really quickly, the GMD test record, it has about a 50% success rate during testing. That's since 1997. During these tests, and we're talking probably 7 out of 15 tests. During these tests, they're highly scripted. We know exactly when the test target's going to be launched. We know what it's going to look like. We know where it's going to fly. We know what time of day it's going to be. I mean, there's zero surprise at all. And to a certain extent, that makes sense. It's very early, and it's testing. You know, it's in baby growth. So, yeah, of course, you're going to have kind of limited testing. The problem we run into is that missile defense supporters take these tests and say, look, you made an intercept. Missile defense has proven itself. Let's get out in the field. And you say, no, not quite. And then just really quickly what David was saying in terms of the media. One of the problems you run into is that this quite literally is rocket science, and I'm a political scientist myself, so I can empathize with reporters. But it's very difficult when they're kind of thrown, okay, now you're doing national security. Hey, cover this missile defense test. And they say, okay, missile defense agency, what do you have to say about that? And, you know, unless you know the subject matter, it's difficult for them to really get down the weeds on it. And to a lesser extent, that's also the missile defense critics' fault, is that we have not been able to come up with a bumper sticker sort of criticism. You know, when people say, well, it's from missile defense, I have to say, oh, look, the testing, the technology. Whereas supporters say, well, don't you want to be defended against an ICBM? Of course. Who doesn't? So it's kind of difficult to be able to whittle down to that level of criticism, and that's something I think we're still working on.
One thing that we found was very interesting, back in 2000, we put out a technical report on the countermeasure problem, decoys and things like that. It had Dick Garwin, Kurt Godfrey, Andy Sessler, some other people on the panel. And we talked about the problem in general, and then we looked at several cases of particular countermeasures that would defeat the sensors within the system. And we expected, when we put that out, to just be bashed over the head by people in the Pentagon. And there was a deafening silence. We were really surprised by that. And after about 2 weeks, we started getting emails from people within the Missile Defense Agency, engineers at a lower level, saying, thank you for doing this, because we've been trying to raise these issues for a long time and nobody's listening to us. So that was, to me, that was a very interesting case of what seemed to me to be one of the really key issues simply not being talked about, but being, you know, being, having a way to sort of bring that to the forefront.
So, Rod, just let me comment. The reason it wasn't talked about is that the system cannot handle sophisticated penetration aids, as the UCS report pointed out. So if those people who want to promote it have to basically bypass that issue, because if you let it come up, the systems won't make it, fundamentally. Again, it's an insight into what's going on here. The people pushing this, to the extent that they understand its capability, don't care about its capability. This is a political project.
Mr. Brown?
John, this is Sugata Bashar with MIT, but when I was with GAO, I was a chief investigator for a failed test of the missile defense program, the first test actually, to look at the sensor and its capabilities, and the test totally failed. Talking about reporters and so forth, I witnessed for 2 years. This is a highly classified investigation. I was probably the only person in the government, other than Phil Coyle, who was the director of operational testing at the DoD, to have read all the reports connected to this test, and they were all classified reports. So very few people actually got a chance to read these things. And I found out what really happened was that the sensor did not fail. I mean, it did fail totally because of lack of cooling in the system. To report that as a scientific report, that this was a super cool sensor that has to cool down 10 degrees Kelvin and did not go down to that temperature, so your noise was very high, you couldn't see anything, let alone discriminate between decoys and warhead, this report could not be put out. I'm responding to John's comments about accountability, is that it was impossible from within DoD to even at GAO, where I was, the watchdog agency of Congress, we could not publish the report the way it should have been published as a scientific investigation. And I would say one more word. When I was doing that investigation, I put out an appeal to IEEE, to APS, to American Physical Society, to American Chemical Society, that if anyone who could help me, especially with the problem of the sensor, because I was not trained as a scientist to really evaluate the sensor performance, I was more of a electrical engineer. And I could not get any response from anyone. Nobody would touch it. Everybody's hand is unfortunately in the trough.
Again, if you are running the equivalent of a Ponzi scheme, you cannot tolerate transparency.
I think we have time for one more, George.
What you said was very interesting. We need a talking point on this. I mean, what I've heard is, doesn't work technologically, it costs too much, there isn't transparency. But, you know, this is not the only program with our political system that it doesn't work, costs too much, doesn't have transparency. Nuclear weapons can kill us, global warming is going to kill us. What is it about missile defense that we can use as an alarming feature to talk it up?
I mean, that's a really good question. When I talk to people about this, you know, certainly September 11th, I said missile defense would have done zero to protect us against the September 11th attackers. If you're looking at national security threats, that's not the way in which to go about doing it. And so if you want to have a reasonable discussion about what's a national security threat, okay, let's look at what we can actually defend against. Missile defense is not that. But again, it's really hard to distill it down to its essence.
Let me just comment that I don't think anybody's been able to come up with a notion that appeals at the fundamental level. Defense seems like a good thing. If we could do it, we should do it. Whatever we try to do, we want to be able to do. That's kind of the underlying argument, and to be against defense in principle is too complicated an explanation to win politically. I wish there were an answer to that, but I'm not, you know, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, nobody's come up with it. Those people are trying to put it in, are always making complicated arguments that go beyond intuitive understanding, and they lose politically as a result of that. I wish I could figure out an answer to that, but it's very hard.
Really quickly, I mean, the thing that I appreciate about that is that Americans tend to be very positive and optimistic, and we put a man on the moon, surely we can do anything, but we put up money and manpower at it. And the thing is, a lot of this, you're just throwing good money after bad, which is a difficult argument to make, that you tend to think, okay, if you do enough, eventually something's going to pan out. Eventually you need to learn how to cut your losses and walk away.
Well, and beyond that is the complicated strategic interaction that goes on with this. People just check out with it, right? The idea that since offense can almost always overwhelm it, if to the extent you're deploying it, you're encouraging more offense. That point, now, you know, I was once on a panel debating this with the head of the Missile Defense Agency, and use the analogy, it's like an overuse or a misuse of antibiotics. You know you're going to get a drug-resistant strain if you do that. He didn't like that analogy because he recognized, well, that's getting close to something that might work politically. But that's basically it. If you deploy a missile defense in advance, particularly, but of the offense, you're going to guarantee you're going to get a penetrating offense. Guarantee it. But that strategic interaction is not in most people's heads. The antibiotic analogy sort of works, but I don't see how you could take that into a national slogan.
Well, if UCS has an 80th anniversary, we may well have the same panel. But I invite you back at that point. We wish we could not to die. Thanks very much for coming, and thanks again to our students.
Are you going to moderate it? Did I understand you correctly that no anti-ballistic missile system would work unless it wanted to?